This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
The relationship between politicians and scientists in the U.S. has always been complicated, and that was especially true during the Cold War.
Ideas about science really did help win the Cold War, but in fairly subtle ways.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the Cold War struggle for the soul of science. Then we'll hear how laptops have become standard equipment in college classrooms across the country, and how using that technology in that setting isn't always a good thing. And we'll spend an academic minute exploring the intersection of STEM and the humanities. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. There is a growing divide among politicians today about science. While many, if not most, still value science as an area for progress and research and educational advancement, there are some, a very vocal some, who see it as a belief system, almost akin to religion. The relationship between science and politics has always been complicated, but they have always been intertwined. That's the premise of Audra J. Wolfe's new book, Freedom's Laboratory: The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. Audra Wolfe is a writer, editor, and historian whose work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and on the podcast American History Tellers. I asked her why she took on this project.
Well, you know, I started researching this project as a biography of a geneticist named Bentley Glass. I had been interested in Glass for a long time because he seemed to go against everything that historians of science thought that they knew about the Cold War. This is a guy who was very politically active. He was somewhat involved in civil rights concerns, and he spoke out against government policies about fallout. But his career only seemed to flourish, and I was trying to understand how this guy could be so politically active and yet still have access to such high channels of power. And eventually I realized that he did actually, his actions weren't nearly as oppositional as they seemed, particularly in the international arena, and that the State Department and the CIA found people like Bentley Glass useful, even while the FBI was investigating him, you know, for issues of possibly being too much on the left. So I began to understand that there was a much more complicated situation happening with scientists and their relationship to power during the Cold War, and I wanted to understand that.
Did science help win the Cold War, or was it just the battlefield?
Well, ideas about science really did help win the Cold War, but in fairly subtle ways. On the one hand, of course, science can be used as a kind of intelligence gathering. So scientific intelligence was certainly important to the Cold War. But the story that I tell in the book is much more about ideas about science, sort of science as a way of life, science as a kind of freedom that was the opposite of how science was being conducted in the Soviet Union. And the United States used these ideas about how science should operate and how scientists should be to try to build relationships with scientists throughout the rest of the world, especially in the global south. And these ideas were really compelling. And by the end of the Cold War, they were fairly common. There was a fairly global consensus that science should operate as an objective approach to gathering facts, and that science should be free from political concerns, and that science shouldn't know borders. All of that was language that came out of the United States position in the Cold War.
However, in the book, you say it was kind of naive to think that science isn't political.
Of course, it's naive, and in some ways it's an aspirational claim, but it's still a useful claim. So to say that science should be apolitical, to say that science operates better under freedom, that science operates best under freedom, that's not a naturally occurring thing. It's something that has to take place from a series of political choices. And during this time period, that was a compelling political choice. But if scientists want to have some degree of scientific freedom, they have to be willing to argue for it, and that itself is a political choice.
I want to just go back to the beginning. How did you get access to this information? I mean, a lot of this stuff was, at the time classified.
Yeah, that's a really great question. A lot of information about the origins of the national security state in the Cold War has been declassified in the past 15 to 20 years, and I did some Freedom of Information requests on my own, so some of the material was declassified very recently. But at the same time, a lot of the stories told in this book are about covers that were blown in 1967. And the thing about a cover organization is that when it's effective, you can talk about it. So organizations that received money from functioning cover organizations organizations could list them in their annual reports. So I found any number of documents in the archives of individual scientists that talked about receiving money from organizations that we now know were actually fronts, in some cases from the CIA, to do some kind of covert diplomacy. So it's an interesting story that you can tell if you know that you're working with a cover. And that's really the trick, is to know what you're looking at.
You talk about the CIA's role with a lot of student organizations in trying to get young people into this. Talk about that a bit.
Sure. Well, so the CIA in general was working with a lot of private organizations to carry out its cultural messages. In part, this was about plausible deniability, that the United States wanted to be able to hide the government's involvement in it, in part because they weren't sure what these individuals would do. But there was also an ideological component, that if the message that you're trying to convey is that the government doesn't control its citizens, it's hard to do that if you're acknowledging the government support. So student groups, the National Student Association was one of the main groups that the CIA was working with in the 1960s, that its cover, when their cover was blown in 1967, that really took the lid off of all of these cover relationships. So the public suddenly learned about the CIA's relationships with labor organizations, with groups of intellectuals, with artists, and with scientists as well, which is part of the story that I'm telling here.
Did both sides of the Cold War work independently of each other, or was there some cooperation?
Well, American scientists and Soviet scientists did actually build some cooperative relationships during this time period. What's interesting and complicated about understanding these relationships is that both the United States and the Soviet Union were also using those relationships to facilitate intelligence gathering. Not necessarily cloak and dagger style intelligence gathering, but some basic facts about how science is operating in that other country. A lot of basic scientific intelligence gathering is that sort of information. Like, what are the key research centers? What are the research strengths? So the United States in particular was encouraging relationships between American scientists and Soviet scientists, and really between American scientists and any number of international scientists, as a way to gather that sort of baseline scientific intelligence. At the same time, these relationships serve to show how the United States was encouraging its scientists to be open and free. So it was simultaneously heightening this contrast with the Soviet Union at the same time that it was also doing something really concretely useful.
If I were to walk up to 10 people on the street right now and talk about the role of science in the Cold War, I'm sure 9, maybe 10 of them would say, oh, you're talking about the space race, right? How much was the space race involved in this?
The space race is a really important example of technological achievement. But what that meant was that for a long time, the Soviet Union was winning that race. And particularly right after the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the United States really didn't think that it was going to catch up. And so the language that the United States used to talk about science in its international propaganda efforts really switched then, in part to draw a contrast between the Soviet emphasis on technology and an American emphasis on basic science. So the United States was drawing up literature, making films, doing radio broadcast that were really meant to highlight that, yes, the United States may not be able to pull off that kind of technological spectacle that the Soviet Union could, but it could be more cooperative. It could be the best scientific partner. It could win Nobel Prizes. So it's a complicated relationship in the late 1950s. And of course, eventually the United States pulled ahead in the space race. But even then, the United States wanted that narrative to be, we managed to do this in a democracy where it's even harder to do technological achievement than it is in the Soviet Union.
There is a lot of talk right now about getting students involved in the STEM activities. How much back then was getting students involved in science? Was it a priority then?
Absolutely. After Sputnik, when the United States was trying to understand what had happened, why the United States was losing the space race so badly, one of the things that they looked at was both undergraduate science education and high school science education. So there were any number of high school curriculum reform projects that were started during this time period in most fields, physics, biology, earth sciences, chemistry. And what's really interesting about these programs is that they all highlighted what they called the nature of inquiry. So the idea was not so much to teach facts, but to teach students to think in a certain way about science. And these books themselves then became part of these diplomatic efforts with both overt and covert agencies backing their translations around the world.
You talk a lot in the book about the concept of scientific freedom. Did either side of the Cold War actually have that?
Well, it depends on what one means by scientific freedom. It's an irony of the Cold War that in the United States, you know, American scientists were receiving more funding from the federal government during this time and in some ways faced more security restrictions than probably at any other time, any other peacetime in U.S. history. So you definitely had to sort of follow certain rules to be able to have access to scientific freedom. But if you could meet those requirements, if you were a white male scientist who had a background without any hint of leftist affiliations, you could get nearly unlimited funding to research whatever you wanted. So this was not a fully open system, and it wasn't open to everyone. But for the people who did have access to it, it seemed extraordinarily free. And so that's part of the tension in this book, is helping scientists understand the difference between advocating for scientific freedom for only some people and thinking about different ways of talking about scientific freedom that might be more equitable for anyone who's involved with science.
Some of those people who got the funding used science or manipulated science to promote some pretty repugnant views. I'm thinking of your story there about William Shockley.
Yes. So William Shockley, he received a Nobel Prize for his work in electronics. He was a pioneer in the science of transistors. But after he received his Nobel Prize, he became very, very interested in what he would think of as race science and questions of the relationship between race and IQ, really repugnant work. So he started using this language of scientific freedom in the late 1960s to try to urge the national academies to do studies about the relationship between race and science. And it's an interesting moment in this story because the scientists involved with the national academies basically said, no, we're not going to research this. This is repugnant. You can find someone else to fund this and do this work if you want to do it. So Shockley accused them of basically being like the Soviet Union, of shutting down research lines. And in this open moment of the late 1960s and early 1970s, scientists with the national academies were willing to say, you know what? Yes, there are some politics here, and we're not going to do this because this work is not helpful and it's not in the service of justice.
You talk also about the use in the Cold War of psychological warfare. I guess Eisenhower was really into that sort of thing. What is psychological warfare? How was it used in the Cold War?
Well, psychological warfare is a fairly broad term, and as national security specialists were using it from the late 1940s through the mid-1950s, it could really be almost anything short of live bullets from uniformed armies. So everything from economic warfare, we can think of the Marshall Plan as a version of psychological warfare, to dropping leaflets over foreign countries, to propaganda of the deed, things like sponsoring concerts that would show the American approaches to music. So there's a wide variety of activities here. Many of them are done covertly without government acknowledgement. But the point of all of them is to avoid a hot war. And the reason that was so important, of course, was because after 1949, both the United States and the Soviet Union had atomic weapons. And so a hot war was almost unimaginable and would probably destroy the entire world. So both the United States and the Soviet Union were really interested in ways that they could further this conflict while avoiding a hot nuclear war.
Well, the Cold War didn't last forever. What happened to science and the government's relationship after the Cold War ended in the late 80s, early 90s?
What's been an interesting postscript, I think for most of the 80s and 90s, when the United States was still using ideas about science and diplomacy, it was mostly as expertise. So the idea that you needed scientific information to answer questions, but not necessarily that you would use science as a way of life to build alliances. That changed under the Obama administration, which really pushed science as a way of life as a sort of olive branch to Muslim countries after the global war on terror. What we're seeing in the current administration is a sea change from these prior administrations, in that all of the prior administrations would at least give lip service to the idea that scientific expertise was important and that both domestic and foreign policy decisions needed access to scientific expertise. The current administration is not particularly interested in scientific expertise, and it's been applying litmus tests for certain scientific views, particularly for climate change. So that's a really dramatic difference, something that we haven't really seen since the end of World War II.
Again, the name of Audra J. Wolf's new book is Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. Still to come, laptop computers are becoming as common as textbooks in some college classrooms. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Technology is replacing the way we do almost everything, including in the classroom. Greg Bradbury shares how laptops are conquering the classroom and how professors use them to aid their classes while also keeping students focused.
Students in Professor Roy Terry's Comm 101 class at Syracuse University are waiting to go into their lecture. But once they go in, the chatter from the students quickly shifts. As Professor Terry begins his lecture, most begin furiously typing away everything he says. Laptops have become a must in college, and since then, students have begun to replace their notebooks with them. Lauren Rube, a student in his class, says it's impossible to keep up without one.
It's much more helpful to be able to use my computer rather than hand notes in Professor Terry's class. He goes very fast, and it's easier for me to type rather than handwrite.
Laptops allow students to keep up in an organized manner that creates an easy place to find what they are looking for. Professor Elliot Lewis in the Newhouse School of Public Communications draws on his own experiences to see the benefits.
I don't think I could have gotten through law school if I did not have the ability to take notes on my laptop, because by taking notes on your laptop, you then create a searchable database.
Not only are they good at keeping track of notes, but they also allow students the ability to access all of their coursework in one place. According to McGraw-Hill, more than 60% of students prefer to enroll in a class that allows technology. Professor Karan Chavrenly in the Whitman School of Management says that this is the perfect match for students and professors.
Thanks to using the Blackboard platform, our students don't have to buy the textbook. Our students don't have to buy any homework access code because we create our own homework assignments. We create our own tests using Blackboard. So everything is online. Everything is prepared by us.
It also can allow students multiple attempts on homework with automatic grading, giving them a better chance to get better grades. The McGraw-Hill study also says that more than three-fourths of professors become more efficient with technology.
So we can use our time to write better lectures, to provide higher quality lectures for the students other than grading.
Almost every student owns a laptop, and seemingly all professors incorporate it into the classroom in one way or another. Classes are able to keep students engaged by following along with readings, PowerPoints, and online quizzes. Everyone agrees that there are lots of ways for students to use laptops during class, but not all of them are good. Laptops in lectures have given students the opportunity to surf the web, distracting those students from taking notes. Studies show if one student isn't focusing, it could cause other students to lose focus as well. This is forcing professors to use the technology for its benefits while trying to avoid its downsides.
I think there are appropriate uses for it. It's just a matter of, you know, do the positives outweigh the negatives? Is it a wash? And different professors come down on that differently.
Professor Lewis does not allow students to use social media in class.
It has to be monitored, and you know, if students are abusing that and are working on things that they're not supposed to be working on during class, then I reserve the right to bounce them out of class or to ban them from using their laptops in the future.
But he admits it's hard to enforce while also keeping the class going.
Sometimes you don't want to stop the class every 10, 15 minutes to call a student out.
While laptops have become normal in the classroom, phones stay mostly out of sight. Professor Avrenly says 95% of his students stay off their phones, but there are times when he wants to engage all of his class. So he began using an app called Flipped. This app tracks student cell phone usage in class, and those who avoid using their cell phone are rewarded with a grade at the end of the semester. So far, he says, the app has been successful.
I don't have a single student who is constantly on his or her cell phone. I almost never see anybody on his or her cell phone. They are engaged.
Students admit to getting wrapped up in social media on their phone during class, and some, like junior Isha Batu, think this is a way to help them stay engaged.
See my notifications on my phone, I just can't touch them. So if my phone lights up, I'll still wonder what's happening, like that's not completely gone. But I do understand the importance of what he's trying to do.
Most college professors incorporate technology into their classes one way or another because, as Elliot Lewis says, they're essentially forced to.
There's probably an argument to be made that writing with a hammer and chisel back in the caveman days helps you remember things more than writing with paper and pencil. But, we got to change with the technology.
And most students, like Madeline Urabe, a student in Lewis's class, are glad professors see the writing on the wall.
We're in the age of technology, so it's almost kind of foolish not to acknowledge that technology isn't, you know, immersing into our lives more.
As technology becomes more prevalent, students are faced with the task of using it for classwork, when with just a couple of clicks, they could be far away from the classroom. I'm Greg Bradbury.
It may seem like the STEM disciplines and the humanities are night and day, but come to think of it, even night and day meet up every 12 hours or so. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Can the humanities and the STEM disciplines overlap? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Mark West, professor of English and chair of the Department of English at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, describes a few examples where applying the techniques of both disciplines was beneficial.
Nearly every week, there is an article proclaiming the demise of humanities departments at universities. These articles are usually framed within the context of a tectonic shift involving the STEM disciplines overtaking the humanities. This framework is fundamentally flawed. A more constructive framework is to think of the humanities and the STEM disciplines as overlapping circles on a Venn diagram. Many faculty members in the English department are deeply involved in science and technology in their scholarship, but their research projects also incorporate the insights associated with the humanities. For example, a literature professor is engaged in a scholarly project on a Romantic-era autobiography titled The History of Mary Prince, which is the first autobiography of a black woman published in England. My colleague is interested in the fact that Prince spent 10 years working in the salt ponds on Turks Island. In his research, he explores the geological importance, chemical qualities, and physiological effects of salt, and he applies the scientific research to Prince's life and writings. By combining the science of salt with the literary and historical analysis of Prince's text, he is producing scholarship that is far richer than would have been the case if he had not incorporated science into his research. Another example involves the research of one of the department's linguists. An expert on language acquisition, this colleague draws on the science of brain development in toddlers in order to better understand their responses to nursery rhymes and picture books. As these examples demonstrate, the humanities and the STEM disciplines have a complementary relationship. So long as humanities departments do not isolate themselves in academic silos, they can still prosper in contemporary academia.
That was Mark West of the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of the Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.